Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with information about an upcoming virtual truth commission on hunger and homelessness sponsored by the Poor People's Campaign. Then we hear about the increasingly bitter situation at Saratoga's Lakeview Mobile Home Park from a resident. Later on, we join in on a tour of the Radix Ecological and Sustainability Center in Albany's South End. After that, we have our weekly labor talk with Willie Terry, who will give us an overview of three current labor struggles, including Amazon unionizing, Major League Baseball, and the striking of nursing home workers. And finally, Moses Nagel tells us about the Figs, who will be playing at the Hangar on the Hudson. But first, here are the headlines.
The city of Troy is planning to invest $13.6 million of the federal American Rescue Plan funds it received on community projects, including childcare. City parks are also on the list, including a possible new pool facility for Knickerbocker Park. Other areas the city wants to spend on include $1 million for education, $3 million for affordable housing and home improvement programs, which includes tearing down and replacing the Taylor apartments lining the Hudson River. Another $1 million could also go towards either replacing or repairing the Lansingburg Firehouse.
State taxpayers could be on the hook for $22.7 million in legal costs related to controversies involving former Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, according to newly updated documents posted on by the state comptroller's office.
The Gazette reports that the mayors of Albany, Schenectady, and Troy gathered Wednesday for what they called a once-in-a-decade press conference to call on the state's Independent Redistricting Commission to leave all three cities in the same congressional district, presently represented by Paul Tonko. Various proposals would shift Schenectady into a different district. Amsterdam is also likely to be shifted into a different district.
Governor Hochul on Wednesday deployed 60 National Guard medical teams to aid nursing homes in New York facing staffing shortages amid surging COVID-19 infections.
And for the second day in a row, the number of new COVID cases in Albany topped 200 on Wednesday, with three deaths, bringing the county's death toll from COVID to 449 since March 2020.
And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. If you like what you hear, find these stories and more at Media Sanctuary. .org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, to check out and the donate link at mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
Now on to our first story. This coming Tuesday, December 7th, the Poor People's Campaign will host a virtual Truth Commission on Hunger and Homelessness. Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Mark Dunley recently spoke with the Reverend Molly Dowell Baum about the campaign and the commission.
We're joined by the Reverend Molly Dowell Baum of the First Presbyterian Church and the Labor Religion Coalition and Capital Region Poor People's Campaign, Focused Churches of Albany, Schenectady Community Ministries, and other are holding a virtual Truth Commission on Hunger and Housing on December 7th. Reverend, what's the purpose of this event and how best can people participate?
Thanks, Mark. And so, as I'm sure you know, the healthcare and housing crises that New York State faces have only increased in severity since the COVID pandemic. So the Capital Region Poor People's Campaign is committed to elevating and centering the voices of those most impacted. So we are hosting an online event called the Truth Commission. And this is also part of a series that we have been doing throughout the state truth commissions. The Capital Region, so it will be Capital Region community members who have been personally impacted by food insecurity and or housing insecurity. They will be testifying about their struggle and how their communities are organizing to build solidarity among the poor and dispossessed.
I understand that in 2017, there was a similar truth commission on poverty in New York State that the Labor Religion Coalition helped sponsor. What was some of the, you know, sort of findings and impact of that commission?
Well, I moved back to New York State just as the pandemic hit, so January of 2020. So I don't know too many details about that event, but I do know that in 2019, the Kairos Center and Poor People's Campaign did a study, a national survey, and discovered that there are 140 million people who are poor or dispossessed in this country. That's almost half of the population. And what do I mean about poor and dispossessed? That is people who have nothing to lose from this current system continuing and everything to gain. People who, no matter what they do, the system does not work for them because it's not intended to. So that we're talking about poor and dispossessed, so that or one small emergency away from becoming so. So a medical bill, missing your pay for a month, not getting your next paycheck, having your car break down. My wife and I are dealing with that right now. Having something going wrong with your house if you own it, or having your rent raised, and so then you can't afford, so you have to move out, or having an eviction causing you to lose your house. Any of these things, and those seem kind of big, but you think about, you know, my kid breaks their arms, and then how many times will I have to go meet a copay over the time that she might have to heal? And if you don't have healthcare, that might make you poor. If you suddenly your job changes over, or you lose your job for whatever reason, that might then make you in this 140 million people. And that was before the pandemic. So those numbers were before the pandemic. So we know that almost certainly the numbers are more now. It's not just those other poor people, I'm saying with like big air quotes, it's us. It's so many of us. And so we're trying to join together and build power, because together we do have power to make changes.
Now, I believe that the First Presbyterian Church is part of Focus Churches, which I know runs both a large food pantry and a breakfast program. You know, how has the pandemic, you know, impacted upon, you know, the people who've been, you know, seeking assistance, particularly with food?
I do want to point out that our co-pastors at First Presbyterian are Reverend Miriam Lawrence Leopold and Reverend Glenn Leopold. They're the co-pastors, and I am the youth minister. And yes, we are part of the Focus Churches, and our food pantry, our interfaith food pantry, and our breakfast club, where we serve friends and neighbors 3 days, 3 mornings a week with a full breakfast. It's to go now. And also then a lunch to go. Those programs have only been seeing uptick in their visitors and those we serve. And also, I want to also share that like I was mentioning, like it's all of us, and it's any one of us at any time can be struck with more need than we have resources for. And that has happened with my family. When our healthcare costs changed, we got different health insurance. We no longer were able to get a very affordable plan. We were on a high deductible plan, and we can no longer afford like all our bills. So I knew that the Focus Churches had this program. After I drop my kids off from school, I go down to Westminster Presbyterian Church, where on State Street, where the breakfast club is on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, if I can make it. It's between 7 and 8:30. And I am greeted by warm friends, and I pick up food that my family then eats that day, or we put it in the fridge and we use it for breakfast the next day too, since they've already gone to school.
Truth Commission on Hunger and Housing, December 7th, 6 p.m. Tuesday. How can people, you know, participate, and why should they participate?
So it is a virtual event. you can, it'll be the evening of Tuesday, December 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. So you can register online and then you'll get the Zoom link. You can participate through Zoom either using a phone, or if you do have access to a computer or device that would have an internet connection and a video camera, then you can participate that way and you'll be able to see see the people on the Zoom screen as well. And the way to register for that is to go to our this website. It's a bit.ly link, if you've heard of that. That simply means type in bit.ly/hungerhousing3r. And hunger, housing, and R should all be capitalized. So bit.ly/hungerhousing3r. And then you'll be able to sign up with your name and email and phone number. And then you'll get email with all the instructions for how to join us. And why should you join us? You should join us if you are interested in your friends and neighbors and how they're doing. We are human people who really need that human connection, and we need to check in on one another. And this is a chance to hear from the people who you might walk by on the street, you might work with, you might live in a building with, and hear, you know, how are they doing? And how has life changed? How have they been affected by just, you know, the changes that happen all the time with our political system, change of administration, with the pandemic, with the ongoing pandemic? How are they doing? And to hear the stories of our friends and neighbors who are facing food insecurity, not knowing if you're going to have enough food or having to scramble for food for the week, for the day, and who are facing housing insecurity, who for one reason or another are not secure in knowing, oh yeah, I've got enough to pay rent for next month and next month. Or I definitely can pay my mortgage. That these are hard stories to tell, and they can be hard stories to listen to, but they are so important because we can only rise to our human, loving capacity to love and help our neighbors and our friends, or be helped and loved by our neighbors and friends if we share our stories. So you will be powerfully impacted by the witnesses of people from right here in the Capital District. And then you will also have a chance to learn what to do next. How are we organizing here and around the whole state and around the whole country to address these problems in a real and sustainable way? So you come to hear the stories, type in your story in the chat too, if you want to, the speakers have already been okay. Called, but you know, you can get involved with us as well.
Okay. We're out of time. We've been talking with the Reverend Molly Dow Baum of the First Presbyterian Church and the Poor People's Campaign, the Truth Commission on Hunger and Housing on Tuesday, December 7th. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
If you didn't catch that link earlier to register for this virtual event, you can find it along with this story on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
In past episodes, we heard about how the new owners of Lakeview Mobile Home Park in Saratoga are forcing residents to leave the property. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Aileen Javier brings us this update on how retaliation has escalated against Angela Kaufman, one of the residents speaking out about the upcoming forced relocation.
We are talking with Angela Kaufman. She is a resident of the Lakeview Mobile Home Park. When we last spoke, he appeared to be targeting you as retaliation. How has it been?
It's definitely escalated. So one example of that, back in September, we had an organizer, Yvonne Maldonado, who was here from Manufactured Housing Action, which is a nonprofit that is all based on peers, people who also live in mobile home parks. And that group helps residents to understand our rights and also advocates for legislative protections for mobile home park residents. So we were intending to canvass to make sure people in the community understood their rights. And Yvonne got to, you know, the very first place we went to, the very first neighbor we started talking to, we're 10 minutes into the conversation. And it appears that the manager of the park called Giovannone, who showed up and like immediately made a beeline for us and interrupted the conversation that the organizer was having with my neighbor. And, you know, part of that interruption was Giovannone saying, "I have all the support here, Angela. You have none. Go crawl back into your hole." And during that encounter, you know, the landlord said to this neighbor something to the effect of that, "I don't know what's coming next," meaning me, like, you know, she doesn't know what's coming next, or, you know, just wait till she sees what's coming next, or something like that. So right as this is happening, Yvonne is also notifying the park manager that she's feeling harassed, and she's telling him, "Stop following us. I'm feeling very harassed." And the manager continually yells at me, basically parroting what the landlord is saying. And his his reply to Yvonne is that if you don't like it, call the police. So shortly after that, the landlord tried to claim my dead end driveway is an emergency access road, on the basis that he, you know, had a crew turn some fencing into a gate, and the gate goes nowhere. It goes onto a lawn behind his boat storage unit. So it doesn't go to a road. And yet he's trying to say this is a safety issue. It's an emergency access gate. This park has been here, somebody said, for 40 years. His boat storage unit has been there for years. And yet suddenly it needs this gate that goes to a piece of lawn behind his boat storage unit for some reason. And so first he tried to steal my carport. And then when he couldn't do that, because I could prove that it doesn't belong to the park, that I bought it as part of the purchase of the home. Since then, he's been trying to insist that it needs to be moved. It also appears he was not happy about the Times Union article, and he tried to accuse the reporter of lying because she published my professional credentials. So apparently he couldn't believe that I had these credentials and was like, you know, asking her for some kind of evidence or something like that. I don't even know.
For the listeners, what are your credentials?
So I am an LCSW, that's a licensed clinical social worker, and it's a state license that people can get when they have a master's in social work and then, you know, another license and so many years of work in the field under supervision.
I mean, why wouldn't he believe your credentials?
Yeah, it's baffling, isn't it? It could be a lot of things. I mean, it could be classism. You know, people think that if you live in a trailer park, you can't possibly be a professional with an advanced degree. And I've noticed, you know, just as a side note, I've lived in apartments, I've lived in a house with a foundation, and I've lived here. And even dealing with, you know, the police, when they show up, there's a very different tone here. You know, there's a very different tone here when they're dealing with me as a mobile home park resident than what I used to hear when they would show up when I was in a house with a foundation or in an apartment. So there's very much an institutionalized classism issue here. So it could be that, it could be misogyny, it could be a combination of the two. I mean, professional licenses are a matter of public record, so he could have just looked it up instead of bothering the reporter. Generally, it appears he's not used to people challenging him, and he's, you know, this whole time he's been responding very unprofessionally. For a while, he was printing things off of my Facebook page and posting them on the bulletin board.
What was he posting from your Facebook page?
Well, I should say that he or somebody acting on his behalf posted a number of different things over the course of the fall. And he can claim that he didn't do it and someone else did. But one of the posts actually had his signature on it. And it was a post I made about the children in the park watching their parents being bullied by the landlord. And he wrote on it something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, you know, "If anyone agrees with these slanderous statements, contact me or the authorities immediately. This woman needs professional help." And then his signature, he signed it. So
now he's going from mobile park owner to have the ability to evaluate someone's mental health?
I guess so. I'm not the LCSW. I guess he is. But that's a good point. I mean, and the ableism didn't end there. I mean, he he told the Times Union that I'm, quote, you know, a psycho. And again, that's another misogynistic, ableist, classist tactic used throughout history to discredit activists. Like, what's one of the favorite tactics of, you know, wealthy white men is to vilify their opposition by calling their mental health and sanity into question and trying to dismantle any credibility they have that way.
So what is going to happen next?
So I go to court on December 7th at 3. And if, you know, if folks are able to join me for the rally, I'd like to kick that off around 2. That'd be great. And I'm basically going to see what happens. I'm not going to give up. This is a matter of environmental and housing justice. And so no matter what happens, I'm going to continue to challenge what he's doing.
For the listeners, how can they help you?
Spreading the word about what's going on here has been tremendously helpful. If other people want to, you know, individuals or organizations want to get involved, please contact me on Facebook. I've had a number of really wonderful local organizations reach out, and they've been helping with the organizing here and getting involved, and that's been tremendously helpful. And you know, as always, you know, good civic engagement. I would say, listeners, if you're the type of person who might read something in the paper or hear something on the radio and you have an opinion about it, make that opinion known, whether it's writing a letter to the editor of the Times Union, voicing your concern or your opinion, whether it's contacting local politicians, the town board at in the town of Saratoga, or even if it's contacting the landlord through his business. That information is out there. He's the owner of Boat and RV Storage. That's the letter N, not the word and. And so that may not be a message that he's receptive to. But again, if you're the kind of person that when you hear something that bothers you, you want to make it known that you don't agree with that, whatever venue you would, you know, whether it's social media or writing a letter, whatever venue you would normally notify authorities of your opinion, please by all means do. And that includes, you know, notifying the Attorney General if you feel moved to do that as well.
Thank you so much for taking the time. And I know it has been stressful for you and the residents. And I will follow up again and hopefully you give us better news.
That would be great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Angela.
That was Eileen Javier talking with Angela Kaufman, a resident of Lakeview Mobile Home Park in Saratoga, about the forced relocation of the residents and retaliation against her by the park's new owners. And we had another interview with Angela yesterday and previously a few months ago. You can find those on our website. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stackbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
Now, frequent listeners will be familiar with the Radix Environmental Education Center in Albany's South End. My co-host, Sina Bazila Hickey, helps us to join RPI Professor Kathy High's classes tour of the center with Scott Kellogg, the Radix co-founder.
Like they say with trees, year one, it sleeps, year two, it creeps, year three, it leaps. That, like, once they get to this point where they can really establish their root systems, they just really explode. Particularly mulberries. I mean, they can put on like 10 feet in a year. No problem. I mean, I'm just like, trying, I do a technique called pollarding, where I just like cut them at kind of chest height and try and manage them more like a shrub or a bushes in places. I mean, it just depends where do you want a giant tree, right? Not right on the south side of where you want an annual garden vegetable bed, so you might want to more actively maintain them. Anyway, can everybody hear me okay? So awesome. Thank you all so much for coming. So hi, my name's Scott Kellogg. I'm educational director here at the Radix, R-A-D-I-X, which is the Latin word for root, Ecological Sustainability Center. And we're a nonprofit organization based here in the south end of Albany, creating a demonstration site of sustainable tools and technologies that are designed to teach urban residents with a special focus on youth how to have greater local access and control over essential resources like food and water, waste management, energy production, with an emphasis on building systems that are simple and affordable, with the goal of coming up with a model that can be transferred throughout cities in the country and the world, because we know more than 50% of the world's population is living in cities. So if we're going to have a serious conversation about just transitions, about transitioning into a world that is more regenerative and equitable, that we need to look at our cities and think about how they can be redesigned or repurposed so they're capable of providing their residents with more of their material needs in terms of food and water, dealing with wastes, energy, but at the same time promoting greater equity and fairness, which is the tricky part. So focusing a lot on teaching ecological literacy to dairy youth, how to do things like grow food and catch water, things that, you know, many times as a consequence of living in a city, you may be disconnected from. Even though we're surrounded by farms and fields and forests here, if you don't have a car, those things might as well be hundreds of miles away. And they're also very likely not going to be spaces that you feel culturally comfortable going to. So we think there's a value to having ecological space, agricultural space, green space integrated into high density urban environments where it's going to be accessible by foot, keeping access, right? That people can come here on a repeat basis, especially kids, and develop like a deeper sense of familiarity with these systems. So we work really closely with Toast Elementary. I just came from there this morning. Giffen Elementary, Ben and Sylvia just went there this morning to work over there. I just was in a meeting with the school district. We have a contract to run garden-based learning, garden-based education with all 12 elementary schools in the district, which is new, and we're trying to figure out how we're gonna do that. But that's really cool and exciting, right? To have something like this kind of space integrated into every school campus, because it's great when kids come here. They're getting a snapshot of a system that's changing and evolving throughout the year. What's really important is for that deeper level of learning and familiarity to come in by seeing how things change day to day. And, you know, there's this huge wave of enthusiasm for STEM, right? Everything STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. I mean, that's all well and good. I mean, I have a critique of, well, what gets left out, right? And why is everybody so enthusiastic about that? But I say to teachers, okay, bring him to a living laboratory, like a garden space or a green space, and you'll see the synthesis of chemistry and physics and biology and ecology, and then we'll add on layers of social sciences and politics and history. Let them get excited about that endpoint application and then work backwards from that point. So that's sort of the goal with that. But yeah, so elementary school age, because we run after school, high school youth employment program. We do a lot of similar things to what the Sanctuary does. I really see Sanctuary as like a partner organization. It's so awesome to have a group that's doing similar types of things, just so you don't feel alone and isolated and like say to yourself, are we insane for no, there's at least some other people who think that this is a good idea, right? And like what's working, right? And what isn't, and to share that, right? That this is intended to be a decentralized and horizontally distributed model, right? That we need different groups in different places doing all these things who are sensitive to the micro-political conditions in the neighborhoods where they're situated. After-school programs for high school youth who come here after school and our stipended. You can get paid for being here, helping with systems here at the Radix and learning about environmental justice issues in the community more broadly. That turns into a five-week summer youth employment program that we do in conjunction with an AmeriCorps program called past two summers, it's been called Pandemic Resilience and Climate Justice, where we have college-age people and high school-age youth working side-by-side to, you know, be gardening in different locations throughout the South End and distributing food, composting, planting trees, all number of different things to try and build a more just and climate resilient city. The textbook Food Desert Neighborhood, probably actually a little better than Troy because we actually do have a Price Chopper downtown. Y'all don't, which is crazy. But yeah, an abundance of corner stores and liquor stores and not much in the way of fresh, affordable, culturally appropriate produce. And this is a big systemic issue, wicked problem, right? We're not going to just fix it by making one garden or one grocery store. There's huge issues that need to be addressed, but we still need to begin nonetheless and move that conversation forward. The angle we mostly take on it is one of food sovereignty, of trying to work with partner organizations like A Village and connect neighbors to garden spaces. There's a ton of vacant lots like Troy throughout the city. I mean, I guess I see that as being a perk of second tier shrinking or plateau cities like Albany and Troy, is that there is an abundance of housing, not necessarily affordable or livable housing, but also vacant space, so we can be advocating for affordable housing and urban agriculture simultaneously, and those things don't have to be at odds with each other, like they often are in star cities with tremendous downward real estate pressure. And urban soils are in really terrible condition for the most part. When we look at, you know, obstacles to growing more food in the cities, access to land is a big one, but the fact that urban soils tend to be non-existent, meaning like they've been sealed, paved over with concrete and asphalt, or they're degraded. So even if you rip up that asphalt, the soil that's underneath is severely compacted. It's almost like rock, and there's not much that's alive in it, or it's been contaminated as a consequence of industry being located inside of cities for the past 150 years, and probably more point-specific, lead paint and leaded gasoline, which were used up until the 1970s, and are still there, still hanging around. The good news is we have ways to try and address that. But I want to quickly, though, talk about the connection between soils and the river and the watershed health, right? That here in cities like Albany and Troy, you know, when we have a heavy rainstorm, it overwhelms our sewer systems, which are called combined sewer systems that have toilets and storm drains drained to the same pipes. Newer cities, they separate those. They keep sewage separate from stormwater. What happens here is that those pipes get overwhelmed and they spill raw sewage into the Hudson River when we have a heavy rain event, which is going to be occurring with greater and greater frequency as climate change advances, because warmer atmospheres can contain more moisture. And we saw that this summer. This was the summer of extreme rainfall. We haven't dried out. Our gardens are still swamps from all the rain we've gotten this summer and have continued to gotten. And this is a design challenge. Like, where do you make that water go, right? When there's just so much water that it overwhelms the absorbing capacity of the soils that you've created and your plants are just drowning. It's a challenge for sure. But yeah, and then when we have sewage overflows in the river, it creates all kinds of public health problems and ecological health problems. The solution would be to put two sets of pipes in the ground. It's going to cost too much money. So what can we do in the meantime? Well, a lot. We can rip up impervious cover. What is impervious cover? Who can tell me? What's that? Yeah, water can't get through it, right? So in a city, that's like asphalt, concrete, and rooftops, rubber rooftops. Trying to rip that up and let the soil get back into the ground. So like when it rains in a forest, the forest floor soaks up the water like a sponge and then it releases it slowly over days and weeks. In the city, we have a condition called flashiness, where it just overwhelms, creates flash floods and overwhelms the sewer systems. So if we can rip up that impervious cover and let the ground soak up the water, we can decrease the likelihood that we're going to get combined sewage overflows. So at this point in history, the last thing we need in cities are more parking lots. Yeah, the whole big perk of living in the city was that you're supposed to have a auto-independent life. But if your city isn't designed to facilitate that, that's difficult, and people end up driving anyway. But we want to try and transition away from that and disincentivize driving a car by, well, maybe making it harder to park. But certainly not building more parking lots, which, you know, cause runoff, but also contribute enormously to the urban heat island. The fact that cities tend to be like 10 degrees or more hotter than surrounding areas, because all that concrete and asphalt soaks up the heat of the sun in the night and then releases it and makes cities sweaty and hot. But for vulnerable populations who have respiratory illnesses, that's life-threatening, that extra heat, that heat stress, especially when you can't afford air conditioning. So let's come on in here and take a look at some of our friends.
The Radix Centers are close partners with us, and if you're interested in learning more about them, we have more radio segments with them on our website, and they also have volunteer hours at the center. You can find out more information can be found. More information can be found at radixcenter.org. In this Labor Talk segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry reports on three labor struggles: the Bessemer, Alabama Amazon workers' struggle for a union, the lockout of Major League Baseball players, and the 1199 SEIU striking nursing home workers.
My name is Willie Terry, and I'm the roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And today, I'm not roaming to an interview. Today, I want to share with you three important labor news stories that involve worker struggle. The National Labor Relations Board orders new union vote for the Amazon Bessemer workers. And two, Major League Baseball locked out their players. And three, I want to share with you the strike by 1199 service employees, which is known as SEIU, International Union, of a nursing home, Campbell Nursing Home, here in our area. Now, I want to start with the Amazon Bessemer worker struggle in Bessemer, Alabama. Yeah, over the past few months during the spring, I covered that particular struggle that was going on in Alabama. And if you want to see my segments about that struggle, you could go on to our website, media.org. Before I go into that struggle or what happened to them or why it is important, I want to give some background information, and that information is about Amazon, the Amazon Corporation. Now, in the capital region, we have some of the largest corporations in the world operating here, and we use their service and shop with them every day. And two of them are Walmart. There's a lot of Walmarts all over the place. And Amazon, which came into our area about a couple of years ago. Now, Walmart is the number one richest corporation in the world, according to Fortune magazine, with a yearly revenue of about $560 billion. And a profit for their owners of about $15 billion. Now, worldwide, Walmart employs about 2,300,000 workers. And these are non-unionized employees. Okay. Now, Amazon is the second richest corporation in the world and has a revenue of $420 billion and a profit for their owners of about 27 billion yearly. Amazon employs around 1,335 million workers, all non-union. Amazon, to a large degree, they use robots. You've probably seen it on television, in place of hiring more workers and as a way to increase their profit. Now, the owner of Amazon is Jeff Bezos. Now, he, according to the Forbes magazine, right, he's the richest person in the world. His net worth is around $177 billion, and he is on the road to being the first trillionaire. He recently flew his own space rocket, if you look, seen it on television, into outer space with his friends for a joyride. Now, someone with this type of power can do anything in their toolbox to prevent their workers from unionizing or having a voice in the workplace. Well, early this year, like I said, during the winter and spring, the retail, wholesale, and department store union, they tried to organize the 5,000 Bessemer, Alabama Amazon workers into a union. And this is not the first time this has been attempted in Amazon Corporation. Now, but when the votes were counted in Bessemer, only 13% cast a vote in favor of the union, and that's out of 3,215 votes. This showed that the workers rejected having a union by more than 2-to-1 margin. Why was this? You know, I wonder, do workers not want to improve their working conditions by having a voice in the workplace? Well, the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, ROWDSU, they filed nearly 24 complaints with the National Labor Relations Board alleging that Amazon threatened workers during this campaign with loss of pay and benefits, and they removed pro-union employees from training, and they installed an illegal ballot drop box among other anti-union tactics that they use. So, after an investigation, the National Labor Relations Board issued a decision confirming that Amazon intimidation and interference prevented workers from having a fair say in whether they wanted a union in their workplace. So as a result of the Amazon misconduct in this election, the National Labor Relations Board, they officially granted a rerun of the union election for the Bessemer workers in Alabama. This was a victory for workers' right to unionize. These multinational corporations who employ millions of workers who have no voice in the workplace, this was a victory. The second story that I want to report on, and a lot of people love baseball, and baseball is American apple pie. On Thursday, or yesterday, December 2nd, the Major League Baseball, where the owners, they locked out the players, and they are in negotiation with the players over their contract. So if you are a Yankee or Boston Red Sox fan or any baseball team fan, there will be no baseball until this lockout is over. Now, the last time there was a lockout, I think it was around 1994-95. And lockouts are done not by a strike of the players, but by the owners. Now, Major League Baseball is a multi-billion-dollar industry with a yearly profit for its owners of about $400 million. The last item I want to bring up is about the nursing home strike. On Wednesday, December 1st, 1199, the Service Employer International Union nursing home workers went on strike at the Hudson Valley Campbell Nursing Home located in Orange County. These workers have been negotiating a contract over the past 3 months. And it was tense negotiation. and 1199 and some of the 250 nursing home employees, they reached a tentative agreement on a new three-year contract. It was a major victory, and it was dedicated to the exhausted workers who were heading into the third year of the raging COVID pandemic. Now, this agreement included guaranteed annual wages increase, protection of health and pension benefits, and add Juneteenth as a paid holiday, among other provisions that will help recruit and retain caregivers during the time of critical staff shortage. Now, the owner of Campbell Hall refused to sign the agreement, so the workers went on strike. As of today, they are still on strike. So stay tuned for further information on that scrubber. This is Willie Terry, your Roman labor correspondent. Thank you for listening.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry reports weekly on labor issues. Willie has extensive experience and knowledge around labor struggles, and we appreciate this overview of these current issues.
And now we turn to art. COVID-19 has had a big effect on musicians and bands. Now that shows are cautiously returning, many favorites are coming back to the area. Moses Nagel spoke with Pete Dunley of local rock legends The Figs about their first performances back here in the Capital Region since 2019.
The Figs are a rock band from Saratoga Springs. They're playing at the Hangar on the Hudson in Troy on Friday night, and it marks their first local show in almost 2 years. That's an unusually long gap for a group that's played tirelessly for decades. I spoke with bassist and singer-songwriter Pete Donnelly about it. I've been going to their memorable shows since I was a teenager. Really, since they started. It must be at least 28, 29 years.
Oh, man. Come on. Keep it going. We're 34.
Oh, 34?
No. Yeah, since Thatcher was prime minister, man.
Wow. For the people out there who don't know The Figs, describe the band to me briefly.
Yeah, that's an interesting task, right? How do we do that? How do we describe The Figs? Generally, when people ask me, you know, they say, well, for lack of a better word, we're a rock and roll band. So what we do have in our sound is that we're always present with our music, and we write music that's about expressing ourselves now. It's a very interactive band. It's a pop band that has a lot to connect with. It's a fun and it's an active and it's an energized experience. I think we've only done one show. I think we did one show maybe a month ago, and we got together a couple times to rehearse and to record, but this coming up here will be our first run of shows in a pretty much 19, 20 months.
Wow. Are you feeling excited? Are you feeling rusty? Is there anything different about your preparation leading up to it?
Yes. I'm definitely feeling rusty, definitely feeling anxious, definitely feeling excited. With every gig I've ever played, I mean, it's in the thousands at this point, I still have this anticipation that is really similar to like any exciting thing where you're imagining it happening and then you're worried about it. You know, like, is the amp going to work? What do I do when the cable fails? Or what do I do if I get stuck in traffic? Or what do I do if I can't remember the words? You know, that's kind of a normal thing. And so in that regard, it's the same, except that I just feel like it's a little bit exaggerated right now because I've had so long to think about it.
I want to ask you a little bit about getting through COVID and what that was like as a performer, as a musician.
Yeah, what a strange year. I think there's two ways to reflect on it. And one is like the universal sense that this has been a really, really awful time. We all know people who died and got sick and lives were ruined. So it's really terrible. For me, I'm one of the lucky ones. You know what I mean? No one in my family got sick. We had moved 6 months before COVID. So we moved into a house where I built a studio into it. And then all of a sudden it was locked down. And here I am stuck in a house with a studio. Like, in that regard, nothing could be better. You know, my introvert was having a field day. You know, I don't have to leave the house. I don't have to see anybody. I can just stay home and write music and play and never get out of my pajamas. I mean, like it feels wrong to say it, but it was a really incredible stretch of creativity. But again, that's because I'm lucky. You know, I'm really, really aware that most people on the planet aren't so lucky. And so I don't mean to gloat about it. I just mean that it created a really unique place for introverts to find themselves. And I didn't miss gigging at all, honestly. Now that we're coming back out of it, I am really excited. And once I get on stage, that familiarity gets unlocked. But I made a record. I actually made two records during quarantine. And one was, I had a pretty heavy influence from this artist, Eddie Harris, sax player, which is just so disparate from the music you might think I make. But it was vampy, and it like entered a state of mind. It was hypnotic, where time, you lose sense of time. And I was really influenced by that music, that where you don't know where the end is. You know, I wanted to enter a sort of honey state, you know, mellifluous, just get lost in the time expanse. 'Cause I'm lonely.
You guys are a really cool example of how to be lifetime musicians and make it work in a way that, you know, that's realistic, but also seems gratifying. And I mean, you've made a life out of music in this band and beyond.
I always joke that if anything, the music industry, music world has told us, it's to not do this. But when you're a person who's a lifer, you know, where it's like you don't have a choice, there's nothing that can stop you. So it's not based on the results, it's based on the activity of doing it. You know what I mean? Like, we don't sell a lot of records. We don't sell out shows around the planet. We do have an avid fan base around the planet, but it's small and mighty. And I joke, like, we've gotten better and better at being obscure. We still do it for the same reasons that we did it back in 87, which was to satisfy some itch about getting together and making something greater than any of us could do by ourselves, and then just letting that energy run.
My son, my six-year-old son, is like a Beatles super fan right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we just started watching that new documentary. And do you have any advice for, you know, for Paul McCartney and friends about how to stay creatively fulfilled with the same group over a long period of time?
Yeah, man. Of course I watched it and I was rapt. Certainly we don't have the pressure on us like the Beatles did. You know what I mean? They let a lot of horrible decisions be made about their finances and things. And luckily the Figs don't really have that pressure. You know what I mean? We can be a little bit more flighty and it doesn't have such a huge impact on our lives. But there is that like selflessness about letting go, giving space to people to be who they really are, and don't necessarily like take everything personally. People's behavior is motivated by all kinds of reasons. And now that we all have families, I really think it put it in perspective that so many of those things that we would get hung up on when we were younger, we just don't anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah, you know, as a dad, it's like, all those things that people used to take so seriously, you're just like, yeah, whatever. You know, I got more important things to worry about. I just feel like it put a lot of things in perspective. Like, every gig isn't the biggest, most important thing in the world. Like, no, I can't do it. You know, my kids got to get to camp that day. And I don't feel guilty about that. And I feel like knowing that it's okay to take your own space is the most important thing, and it kept the Figs alive. Many times over the years, I said, guys, I need to do my own thing, or go make your own record, Mike, or I would make my own record, and I would play with other bands. I don't think, if we didn't have that space, I don't think we would have survived. The Figs are in a really creative place. It's been really challenging for us to find each other through this year. And I think coming back into it, we're feeling good. And we have more songs than we can learn, but that's always been the state of the band. And I think anyone who's going to come out to see us can expect something unique in every show, and that we are so grateful to be playing, so that we would just love it. If anyone can, please come and join us for these experiences, because they're harder and harder to create and harder and harder to get to as we get older, and who knows what variant is coming down the door. So every show to me is the most precious thing ever. So I always said, and my last comment was, this is like, never disrespect the music, man. Like, you know, as a musician, you see a lot of people bum out when things don't go their way. And I'm like, you're not really in control. So just let it go and just let the music guide you and you'll be okay.
The Figs music is on Bandcamp and all the other streaming sites and at the Figs, FIGGS.net. Info about the show on Friday can be found at thehangerontheHudson.com. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
Well, that Figs concert, that will be on Friday, December 3rd at the Hangar on the Hudson. That is 675 River Street in Troy. And for more information on the event, hangerontheHudson.com.
And now a message from the producers. As a reminder, this program is produced entirely by volunteers. We welcome you to join us in creating stories, co-hosting sessions, or even learning how to engineer if you like. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, and to find out more about the different types of volunteers we can use, you can check mediasanctuary.org and click on the donate button. You can also email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And if you like, join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07. You tell us you're interested and we will tell you how to join us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Basila-Hickey. And our engineer is Kaylin McPherson. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
And tune in every weekday at 6 to 7 p.m. to hear live broadcast of local news, which is re-aired at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. the following weekday. Stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org, or you can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Enjoy a little bit of music now.